This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Priyanka Bakaya, who is the CEO and founder of PK Clean. PK Clean is a clean tech firm working to solve the issues of the plastic waste that is filling up our landfills and polluting our oceans. The scope of the problem is enormous. As Americans, each of us generates 4.5 pounds of garbage every day. Much of this waste is plastic, and that will never decompose. Fortunately, plastic is made from oil, and it can be converted back into oil. Unfortunately, the process to do so is expensive. If you remember your high school chemistry labs, the conversion is what's called endothermic. That means it takes a lot of energy and money to do this. Priyanka and her team think they found a way around this hurdle, and lots of smart people agree with them. In partnership with Utah's largest recycler, Rocky Mound Recycling, PK Clean has developed a full-scale commercial plant right here in Salt Lake City to begin recycling plastic. Join us this morning to hear why this Stanford undergrad decided to pursue a career in waste, become a respected clean tech entrepreneur along the way, and hopes to leave the world a better and less polluted place. Priyanka, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
So let's start with the basics. Tell us what PK Clean does.
Sure. So you did a great job with the introduction. Basically, PK Clean's mission is to end plastic waste forever. So what we do is we take plastic waste that can't typically be recycled. And in the U.S., only about 9% of plastic waste gets recycled. People don't realize it's so low, but it's actually very difficult to recycle plastics because to recycle them, you need to separate them into their specific number type, and it becomes very difficult to sort them by number once they're all mixed together in the trash can. So we work on the types of plastic that don't typically get recycled, and our process takes the plastics back down to their basic molecular level and back to the oil from which they came from. And so that's sort of the process, sort of at a high-level view, is we're taking that plastic waste and converting it back into
So it
fuel.
Sounds like there's several problems there. One is there's 7 main categories of plastic, and my understanding is 2 of those are relatively frequently recycled, but the rest are not. It's also labor-intensive to separate out the quote-unquote good plastics, the ones that are easy to recycle from those that aren't. Does your process allow you to avoid that sorting setup?
Exactly, yeah. So you're correct. Typically, number 1 and number 2 plastics get recycled. So number 1 are things like PET bottles, water bottles, soda bottles. Number 2 is HDPE. It includes things like the foggy milk bottles. So those are very easily identifiable. Those can get sorted, at the waste facilities. They have optical sorters or people picking through. They're sort of very easily identifiable. And then they get left with sort of a mix of plastics. It's known as the numbers 3 through 7 mix. And our process is able to take any type of mixed plastic, and for us, it doesn't matter what the number is because we're taking it to that basic molecular level where it really doesn't matter if, you have 2s mixed with 5s, mixed with 6s. The process just breaks it down.
And is the sorting process, is that half of the cost, or is it a pretty insignificant piece, the whole sorting process?
Yeah, so we don't do the sorting ourselves. So the sorting happens at the recycling facilities. So companies locally like Rocky Mountain Recycling and Waste Management, when you put things in your blue bin, it gets sent to them. And they separate out the plastics from the paper, from cardboard, aluminum.
So they're taking the ones and twos.
And they take the ones and twos.
And they have an outlet for that. And mm-hmm. they're bringing you the rest.
Exactly.
For this process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get the residue from that.
Okay. And so you guys, I mentioned it's what my undergrad's in chemical engineering, so I know a little bit about at least high level this space. Mm-hmm. I mentioned it's an endothermic reaction, which means unfortunately you've got to heat it up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's expensive to heat stuff up. You have a catalyst that you're using. A catalyst is, just think of it as magic dust that allows you to lower the amount of energy you need to do something. Fair enough?
Yeah. So the key to the process is the fact that so plastic is sort of pure energy. It's like 100% energy to begin with. So our process, we get about 70 to 80% comes out as the liquid fuel. And then about 10 to 20% becomes a hydrocarbon gas similar to natural gas. And that is recycled to heat the system. And we produce enough natural gas from the system itself to keep it heated. So we don't need any external energy once the process is started. And that's really what makes it an efficient process where you're generating much more energy out than you have to put in because you're able to heat the process using
the
plastic
itself. What's new? As you described this, I got my engineering degree in 1987. Everything you're describing was possible in 1987. Why are we here 30 years later and a startup is breaking new ground in this area?
Sure. Yeah, no, it's interesting. You know, as long as we've made plastic, it's sort of been known that you can convert it back to oil. And initially, you know, there had been research. The economics didn't make sense. And back then, oil prices were a lot lower, like around $20 per barrel. So, you know, and plastic wasn't such a, you know, big issue back then either. What we've seen is in the past decade or so, with oil prices going higher and just the plastic usage becoming, you know, just so widespread and really becoming a huge issue.
So nobody really cared before is what you're saying. It was completely from a technological standpoint,
it was very possible.
Mm-hmm. So shame on us as a society. It's good news, but it's horrible. We went three decades without addressing this when it was completely solvable. The price of oil, as you know, has been above $30 a barrel. That's what, as I did some research, your break even's about $30, $35
That's
a barrel,
right. Yeah.
Which is the same as what it costs in many of the fracking fields out there, which damages the environment as opposed to your process, which is improving the environment. Okay, so that gives us an idea of the economics of it. Tell us what attracted you to this. So you grew up in Melbourne, Australia.
That's right.
You got accepted to Stanford. You went there, studied in economics. You went to Stanford. When did you graduate from Stanford? What year?
2005.
2005, and if I'm not mistaken, Al Gore's movie Inconvenient Truth, which really launched the clean tech industry that we know it today. That came out right about the same time.
That's right.
Was clean tech starting to become an interesting space while you were at Stanford, or did you do this before clean tech became hot?
Yeah, no, it wasn't at all while I was at Stanford. My first job after Stanford, I was doing energy research, and at that time, oil prices started to get higher and people were looking at alternative energy. And that's when I started to get really interested in this space. I'd always been really passionate about the environment from a young age, and especially growing up in Australia, recycling is just sort of a bigger thing. And what struck me when I moved to the U.S. was just sort of the amount of waste that was getting generated and just the way people sort of thought about waste. It's, you know, like, they put things in a trash can and they think it just magically disappears without really thinking that, oh, you know, this plastic's actually going to be around for hundreds of years, like, you know, well beyond when we all die. And, you know, people don't really think about the consequences of the waste and just, you know, weren't as sort of conscious of recycling and different techniques. So I'd always been passionate about that from a young age. And another key influence growing up was a family friend of ours in Australia. His name was Percy Keane, and he was a alternative energy inventor. He was a chemist by training, and he had basically, he was a bachelor, and he was an elderly man who converted his house into a giant chemistry lab. And so I was very fascinated by what he was working on as a child. And he'd show me oil samples and tell me he'd made them from, you know, various waste products. And that really captured my imagination as a child. And it was only later when I was working in energy research and the oil price was going up, and I thought back to his technologies that he had developed. And he'd only done it at lab scale, never commercialized them. And he actually passed away around that time in 2007. He was aged 95, so, you know, he was quite elderly. But I went back and started looking through some of his notes, and that's when I decided that I was going to go to MIT and try to, you know, figure out which of these technologies made the most sense for commercialization. And that's how I ended up focusing on the plastic waste piece.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Priyanka Bakaya. She is the CEO and founder of PK Clean. I'm curious. I mentioned you grew up in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
You said that recycling is a bigger deal there.
Mm-hmm.
How is waste handled, household waste handled differently in Australia than here?
Yeah, I mean, it's still the same concept of recycling bins. You know, there were multiple recycling bins we had sort of growing up. But I think there was just like more emphasis on education just from a young age, just, you know, across all schools. It's really sort of drilled into you to be recycling everything. And I just didn't find that that same mentality was here. And I don't know if it just maybe isn't
drilled in. It's a little better now. I remember maybe a decade ago, everybody would drink these little water bottles, these plastic water bottles, and throw them away. And now I think everybody frowns on that, which is a good thing for obvious reasons.
Yeah, and it depends where in the country you are as well. Like there's definitely, you know, if you go to places like California, just, you know, really, you know, people are extremely conscious, and then, you know, other parts of the country just aren't quite there yet.
So this is a passion that you took up several years after graduating from Stanford. You did traditional Wall Street type work, if I'm not mistaken, it was Lehman Brothers, right out of Stanford.
Yeah.
And then you decided to get your MBA at MIT. Were you thinking that you wanted to pursue this technology? I mean, MIT would be the perfect place to get your MBA if ahead of time you had identified this as a space you were interested in.
Yeah, basically the reason I had gone to MIT and chosen MIT was because I knew I wanted to focus on this technology or looking at alternative energy. And I'd actually sat in on a class called Energy Ventures there when I was just sort of looking at the school, and it was sort of the perfect thing where they were commercializing technologies and, you know, bringing them these startups to market, and I thought it was just really the perfect place to, you know, get some more skills and growing this technology and getting it off the ground. So,
and how did that play out? What do you think? Getting your MBA from MIT as opposed to some of the more, it's one of the top programs in the country as well, but as opposed to maybe a Wharton or a Harvard or a Stanford,
right.
What do you think the MIT experience gave you that you might not have gotten at other places?
Yeah, I mean, it's, for one, the MIT MBA school is just very hands-on compared to the other schools. You know, you're thrown into all these sort of labs and classes where you're building companies in the class itself. So it's like less sort of case method and that type of thing. It's very hands-on, and there's more interaction with the different schools, the engineering school. Really the reason it exists is to be working with that engineering school and, you know, focusing on sort of, you know, commercializing some of those technologies that are happening on campus. So there's definitely just a really strong engineering science focus, and just the local Boston community. You know, there's just a lot of involvement of the local science companies, local like venture capitalists who are investing in this space. So it's a really great ecosystem to sort of learn about, you know, what's possible in terms of commercializing these technologies, seeing other startups who have gone through it, and, you know, understanding just what investors are looking for as well. So I think for me, that was just a really helpful education because I knew I wanted to do this, but I, you know, felt that there was just so much I didn't know to, you know, in terms of getting started.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Priyanka Bakaya. She is the CEO and founder of PK Clean. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Priyanka Bakaya. She is the CEO and founder of PK Clean. So we're talking about some of the ways the MIT experience helped you. You mentioned investors. Let's talk about that. I know you've won a multitude of clean tech awards and grants. Has that been your primary source of funding?
So initially that was, you know, the primary way we got funded because, you know, it's very hard to get capital in this space. You have very...
It used to be easy.
It did. There was
about
a period...
10 years ago, it was pretty easy.
Exactly. And what happened was a lot of those investors, they'd come out of the tech boom and they thought, okay, clean tech is the next internet bubble. And, you know, could not be any more different in terms of sort of investment horizon. Clean tech, it just takes a really long time. Usually VCs are looking, you know, to exit within 10 years. And, you know, the first few years of clean tech, it's like you're still lab scale and you're still, you know, scaling up. So it's, you know, the investment horizon doesn't quite fit. And that's something that I was sort of lucky that I had seen that first wave of clean tech investments not go so well, and we could learn from that and not take a huge amount of VC money early on. If we had, we probably would have also gone bust because we would have taken too much, been forced to grow too quickly, and, you know, not let the technology just sort of mature on its own course. So we tried to avoid the traditional VC route, even though I, you know, had sort of the opportunity of all these VC firms sort of right there in Boston and with the Stanford connection. We decided to focus on grants. And then, you know, once we got to a certain scale, we were able to get like most of our current facility in Salt Lake City is debt financed, and, you know, just sort of avoided the traditional venture capital route in terms of funding and, you know, tried to be more innovative to find, you know, more patient sources of capital.
You also went to an incubator. Mm-hmm. There's a local incubator here in town, Boom Startup, Rob Coons and his team. Which incubator did you go to, and how was that experience helpful to you?
Yeah, so right after graduation from MIT, we went to the Lightspeed Ventures Incubator, which is in Silicon Valley on Sand Hill Road. And at the time, there was a clean tech investor, and most of the funds focused on internet. So actually, some of the founders of Snapchat, their initial team, were in that incubator with us. And, you know, a lot of, you know, we were the only clean tech ones. But that was a really great experience to, you know, get us focused on, you know, achieving sort of the commercial viability that we needed. And I think also just learning on how other startups similar to us had grown and sort of getting more of an in-depth view on, you know, what some of the challenges might be ahead of us. And after that is when we decided to move to Utah to get this started. And it was just sort of the right ecosystem for us. We had a research contract with the University of Utah. There's the local refineries here. Also just sort of getting things fabricated locally, we knew we'd be able to do. So there was a lot of advantages with moving to Utah. And, you know, I'm glad we sort of made that decision right after the incubator to come
now,
here.
As we speak in the studio today, this morning just aired the show where we talked with some folks from the state on economic development, as well as the mayor of Ogden from the local aspect. Was there some economic development dollars that helped bring you here?
Yeah, no. I mean, not initially. We got here, and then we realized there was also money here as well. So that's been a huge help. So our first loan was through the Salt Lake City Economic Development Loan Fund, and, you know, we had a great experience working with the city on that. We ended up repaying that loan. The other interaction was with the Utah's Governor's Office of Economic Development.
Go ahead.
Through their TCIP grant program. So,
which is usually given out in increments of $100,000.
Exactly.
So they're pretty significant.
Yeah. So that was a big help as well, getting that money from TCIP.
Okay. And so now you have a commercial scale facility here in Utah. This is pure manufacturing. This is physical equipment.
Mm-hmm.
What does it cost to build something like that? Is it in the $10 million range? Is it in the couple million dollar range? What's the scale?
Yeah, it's in the couple of million dollar range. And we've done all the design, fabrication, everything in-house, both to be able to sort of control the design and iterate very quickly, but also to keep costs low. And so the system we've developed is a lot lower than what some of our competitors have been able to do, just from sort of being smart about the design and, you know, doing things in a lower cost way in-house rather than outsourcing it to expensive engineering firms.
And I mentioned in the open, you have a partnership with Rocky Mountain Recycling, which is the largest recycler in the state. How did that come about?
That's actually an interesting story. So our advisor at the University of Utah, Professor Eric Eddings, he's been sort of extremely helpful throughout the process of our commercialization. But he was in a singing group, a barbershop quartet with the owner of Rocky Mountain Recycling. So that was sort of an interesting introduction.
It pays to be well-rounded, people.
Yes.
Keep pursuing these outside passions.
So, you know, that's the great thing about Utah is just sort of how connected everyone is. And, you know, it's just literally like seems like a degree of separation between everyone at the end of the day. So
you have an unusual business. Normally you have to pay for your raw materials.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, right now, Rocky Mountain Recycling is likely paying to get rid of what they're shipping to you. Do they pay you to take their materials?
Yeah, so typically these waste
Good,
companies.
They should.
Yeah, no, they have to typically landfill this waste. There used to be a market for it. So actually a couple of years ago, China used to buy this material for like a couple of cents a pound. And essentially what was happening was all the ships that bring things from China go back empty. And so, you know, it makes sense to just sort of dump our waste in China. But China started cracking down on this a few years ago as they realized sort of the pollution problem in the country was getting out of hand. And they introduced this thing called the Green Fence Initiative, which was, you know, essentially at their ports, they just stopped accepting some of these trash bales because they want the recycling materials, like the good, like pure PET bales that goes back to China and they make, you know, toys and clothing and, you know, all these
goods
out of them.
But that can be processed here in the U.S. That doesn't solve the problem.
That's true, yeah. But, you know, so what we were doing was just like literally dumping trash on them. So they've cut down on that. So now there's less avenues for these waste companies to send their material offshore. You know, onshore, there's sort of limited options as well. And yeah, unfortunately, a lot of this material does end up getting landfilled.
Landfilled and somehow in the ocean. You know, I've heard
yes.
about these giant floating
mm-hmm.
landfills, ocean fills. I don't know why it aggregates together, but mm-hmm. tell us about that problem.
Sure, yeah. So there's 5 trillion pieces of plastic waste in the oceans, and forecasts show that by 2050 there'll be more plastic than fish in the ocean. So it's really becoming this huge issue. And you know, a lot of us, especially in a place like Utah, you know, where we're not on the sea, we don't see the issue, but you know, when you talk to people who actually sail, it's, you know, really devastating when you go into the open waters and you expect it to be all beautiful and pristine and you can be in the remotest area and it's still just the ocean is like literally just like filled and saturated in plastic, especially things like the Pacific Garbage Patch. It's been named.
It's bizarre that it, yeah. I guess, the currents all
like,
kind of bring it together.
Literally, yeah, like a floating island of
plastic.
And
that problem's not going to take care of itself.
No, yeah, it just sort of keeps getting worse. And some of it is just due to, it's not that people are, you know, going out of their way to dump plastic in the ocean. It's just through, you know, throughout various leaks in the system, it's making its way to the ocean. Unfortunately, a lot of, like, developing countries will also just openly dump as well and into the ocean. So it's getting in there through lots of different ways. And, you know, our hope is through processes like ours, by giving this plastic waste actual value, that, you know, you'll see less of it entering the ocean because people will realize that, oh, this isn't waste. This is actually something that's very valuable.
Well, the alternative is they have to pay to get rid of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
The folks that pick up the trash at our businesses and our
sure.
homes,
yeah.
they sort it. They're regulated. There's ways that they have to handle
mm-hmm.
it that costs money.
Yeah.
And landfills are filling up. I heard that New York City, a lot of their garbage goes all the way as far as Ohio.
That's right. Yeah.
I live up in Park City, and the, mm-hmm. the dump up there is filling. And the next dump that will take trash from Park City, I believe, is in Tooele, which is like 50, 60 miles
yeah.
away,
mm-hmm.
Which creates all kinds of other issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scale of what you're doing, I just did some back-of-the-envelope calculations here. I had a number that 20,000 pounds of this waste will generate 2,500 gallons of fuel. And so I just did some, you know, assume it's worth $1 a gallon, which is low, but it made my math easy. And assuming that there's there's 100 soda bottles in a pound, I don't know, I could be off by a little factor here. But essentially, your revenue is about one penny for every eight bottles, water bottle size container. Boy, it's hard to make money that way. I know you're now in a commercial facility. How is it going? Is it are you able to do what you were hoping to do and get? I know oil's at $50 a barrel as we speak here, so you should be doing okay. It should be. Is it a profitable venture?
Yeah. So when we started out, the oil was definitely at a higher price, and you know, over $100 per barrel, and you know, the decrease in the oil price, it impacted us. But what we did was we improved our separation process on the back end to make more of a finished product. So now we get more of a fuel that's similar to diesel. And diesel usually sells for like $20 to $30 per barrel above the crude oil price. So that's what, you know, makes the economics still make a lot of sense in this environment, even with oil prices.
And you can change that split, right, by how much energy and the process that you use and how you distill it.
It's just, yeah, it's sort of a cooling process at the end where it's like a distillation tower and you're taking off different cuts.
So on a marginal basis, it is proven to be profitable.
Yes.
Yeah. So what's the path forward? You've got the facility here in Utah. You could probably make that facility 10 times larger and still have more plastic to handle. Is it to stay here in Utah, or do you hope to roll this out nationwide?
Yeah, the hope is to co-locate where the waste is, and because transportation is such a big issue with waste, especially plastic takes up a huge volume, and so once you transport it long distances, it's, you know, not only bad for the environment, but it's, you know, got a heavy cost to it as well. So our plan is to go where the waste is and set up facilities, you know, in other big cities across North America. So our next facility is actually going to be set up in Canada next year. That's where we're going for the second one. And there's other cities we're talking to throughout the country as well. Especially
and
the
so
East
Canada's
Coast.
So Canada's a little bit of distance from here in Utah. Is that because there's research dollars, there's incentive dollars to get you to go
yeah,
there?
Yeah, the Canadian government is great about so our partner who in Canada, they've been able to raise financing there. Also, just some of the costs make a lot more sense, like the landfill cost is a lot higher. Utah actually has one of the lowest landfill costs in the country just because we have more space out here. The fuel market is also better out there as well in terms of sort of selling the product. So the economics are just sort of more suited.
Well, once you get it rolled out there and work out the bugs and get it streamlined, then I would imagine the game plan is throughout the United States, co-locating these really throughout the world.
Exactly, yeah. And there's a lot of demand. You know, we have on our website, our contact form, you know, literally inquiries just from all types of countries around the world just, you know, wanting to know when the solution will be ready for us to take out there. So, yeah, there's a huge amount of demand everywhere.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Priyanka Bakaya. She is the CEO and founder of PK Clean. I want to go back to something you said earlier when we were talking about the incubator. You mentioned the founders from Snapchat. Is it Michael Evans?
Yeah, so the main CEO wasn't there, but yeah, some of his co-founders were there.
Okay, and you know, that's a really interesting product. It's an interesting app. It's a great way to communicate. I actually heard you probably remember waiting to get the acceptance letter, whether you got into Stanford or not. they're not doing that anymore. They are sending high school seniors Snapchats.
Oh, my gosh.
Snaps and saying, hey, congratulations, you've been accepted. Not Stanford. There's another top-tier school that is doing that.
That's
so, you know,
funny.
The world is changing. And good for folks like Evans and his team for creating something like that. I am somewhat troubled by some of the best and the brightest minds, and Elon Musk talks about this. You know, really, so much effort because of the venture capital community and where the investment dollars flow to. Mm-hmm. Some of the world's best minds really are trying to figure out how to make us click on ads on the internet, right. on mm-hmm. our phones more. And that just seems like such a waste of mm-hmm. talent.
Definitely.
What got you beyond that into something like what you're doing today?
Yeah, for me, I always knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur. Growing up, my father was an entrepreneur, and the reason I came to Stanford was because it's, you know, known for entrepreneurship. But for me, it wasn't enough to be an entrepreneur. I wanted to do something socially impactful, whereas, you know, doing something meaningful with my life. And when I got on campus at Stanford, clean tech didn't exist, but this idea of social entrepreneurship was starting to get some buzz. And I took actually a class at the MBA school right when I was freshman or sophomore, maybe, on social entrepreneurship, and just sort of got, you know, more connected to people doing, you know, really impactful things. And that really inspired me at that time. And I knew that, you know, no matter what I did in the entrepreneurship realm, that I wanted to do something where I was making a positive impact in the world. And for me, I'm, you know, originally of Indian heritage, and we would go back every year or two to visit India, and, you know, just sort of seeing the extent of poverty there, you know, the waste pickers on the road, you know, trying to make a livelihood. I knew that for me, you know, I'd been given all these great things in life and, you know, an amazing education. And for me, it was just important that I didn't waste that opportunity and, you know, used what I'd been given in life to make a positive impact on society.
And what kind of got you to actively pursue that? Right out of Stanford, you took a fairly traditional path mm-hmm. going to work for Wall Street. What was it that got you back and saying, I want to go back to that original passion, being a social entrepreneur?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's interesting you bring up the Wall Street thing, because, you know, people associate it as this, you know, awful place. And for me, when I went, I knew that I felt that I needed skills before I started launching my own thing. And I think, you know, often you could probably just start a company straight out of college and you'd be completely fine. But in my head, I was like, oh, I don't know anything about the real world. I need someone to teach me how the real world works and then go start my company.
I'm actually a fan of that approach for most mm-hmm. entrepreneurs.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely learned a lot. But I think sometimes people think, oh, this real world thing is going to teach me a lot. And then, you know, you get there and you realize people don't actually know what they're doing. And in my case, Lehman Brothers was this, you know, very prestigious firm that went bankrupt. And I think seeing that, you know, even these sort of big blue chip, supposedly blue chip companies can also fail, it, you know, made me realize that, hey, you know, I have nothing to lose starting a company from scratch. So, you know, that was an interesting lesson. But I knew at the time that I wasn't going to stay on Wall Street for long. I knew I was just sort of going to learn the skills I needed. And, you know, I actually had Steve Jobs was the commencement speaker in 2005 at our graduation. And I had his speech on my desk. And, you know, he talked a lot about, you know, if you don't wake up every day being excited by what you do, you know, it's time to move on to the next thing. And
it's one of the greatest commencement speeches. Lucky you that you got to hear that live. Mm-hmm. But it's available on YouTube, and everybody should YouTube
it. Everyone should listen to it.
It's very inspirational. Yeah. Of course, Steve Jobs passed away now. I think 5 years, the anniversary just came up. But you should definitely listen to it. Mm-hmm. You know, now that you're wearing the hat of the entrepreneur, mm-hmm. And you've done a lot, it's been a long path. You started mm-hmm. this PK Clean 2010, mm-hmm. So you're almost 7 years in. What's been a few of the biggest surprises, some of the more challenging things?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it can be very overwhelming. Obviously, what we're taking on is not a sort of small task. It's sort of, you know, huge magnitude, and it can be really overwhelming thinking about all sort of the goals we've set for ourselves. But I think the important thing is just to sort of take it step by step and each day at a time, and, you know, focus on what you can do today without getting, you know, overwhelmed by how much is ahead. And there's a lot that you won't know about, and, you know, we've been hit with all kinds of things that you have to get up to speed on. Obviously, you don't know about everything starting a company. But it's really about just sort of having that mindset that, you know, whatever you, you know, apply your mind towards, you can always find a solution. And sort of what's kept us going is, you know, having that end vision inside, but not getting too overwhelmed by the goal at hand.
Are you now working? There's a another company. It sounds like it's in the researching for people on Wall Street, different industries. Are you doing that while you're also running PK Clean?
Yeah, so that's actually our family business. My father, I mentioned, is an entrepreneur, so he has a financial research company, and so I serve as a director on that. And in my copious spare time, I do help out with managing that company as well. And it's one of the reasons I also wanted to get the initial training on Wall Street, was so that I'd be able to, you know, always be able to help out with that and be, you know, literate enough to do that. So yeah, that's something I do on the side, which, you know, keeps things interesting to get out of the clean tech space a little bit as well.
Yeah, no, it's nice to have a balance of both of those. Well, as I mentioned in the open, hopefully the world ends up being a better place and a cleaner place because of the work you're doing at PK Clean.
Thank you so much. We hope so, too.
Our guest this morning has been Priyanka Bakaya. She is the CEO and founder of PK Clean. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. You can hear my entire interview with Priyanka on our website, kcpw.org. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.